everybody. Welcome to Feminist Buzzkills, the show that has already hired and fired Rona McDaniel. Okay, no, we haven't. Would we ever do that?
We would never do that.
Not in a million years. I'm Liz Winstead, and as always, I'm with my illustrious co-host, Moji Adebodeyel.
Hello. Today, we're going to talk about the mifepristone oral arguments at the Supreme Court. Liz and I did some pre-gaming, and Alyssa's still at SCOTUS and is going to call in and give us the vibes. And then the main event, we break down the arguments with expert analysis from the best guests possible, Dr. Michelle Goodwin, O'Neill Professor of Constitutional Law and Global Health Policy at Georgetown Law.
Plus, she knows all about everything that has to do with all SCOTUS everything, not to mention she is one of our illustrious Abortion Access Front board members. What? It's true.
Minor flex.
So if it sounds a little off, it's because we are in a conference room in a hotel in Washington, D.C. We came down Tuesday night before the oral arguments and schemed and plotted. And then Moji and I and Dukes and Kristen somehow volunteered ourselves to be space savers at the Supreme Court. And what that means is
you get there at 4 a.m. and you wait.
And you wait.
You just wait.
Because little known fact is you never get to reserve spot at the Supreme Court for oral arguments because it's public space.
Right.
So the only way to claim your public space is by going there and taking it. So every time one of these Supreme Court cases happens, you get there damn early. So
somebody has to. So we were the four people from AAF, but there were other orgs that also had bodies in space. And all we were doing was just standing around playing music because our people rock.
Yeah. And the ACLU made homemade banana chocolate chip cookies.
Oh, my goodness.
They were delightful.
Oh, so good.
And then the anti-abortion. So they divided up kind of straight down the middle a little bit where they put cones and we set up our speakers and our stages on one side, and then they set up on the other side. And every time they do this weird thing where all the men folk gather,
yes,
and then they have some kind of prayer session, which is yes, super uncomfortable.
Yes.
And then there's like Supreme Court Con, which is sort of like Supreme Court watchers line up even earlier than us to try to get into the hearings.
I actually learned this time that there is two lines. There's one line where the people will literally have sleeping bags and tents and camp all night. And then there's the line for the lawyers. I called it the $100,000 line because they just showed up at 6 a.m. like the rest of us.
Yeah. But so we were there and it was interesting to watch like how people filtered in and what the vibes were outside of the court. The interesting thing about the anti-abortion movement this time is because Alliance for Defending Freedom through their rally. Normally it's some activist group. And so they get the wildest of creepiest activists with the big fetal porn signs and all that stuff. Well, Alliance for Defending Freedom, their signs were the same color as our signs were last year, that teal color. And then their signs were super innocuous, which I thought was interesting.
I call it the respectability riot signs. They said, it said women's health matters, which I was like, absolutely. And then I think the subtext that they didn't write on it was ban mifepristone.
Yes. And then they also had signs that said FDA, do your job. And I'm like, co-sign.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it would made it confusing, I think, for like, if you were new to the court and you were on our side, you might be hanging around with them for a minute.
But then Powell came and they brought the crazy.
Oh, yeah. What are they called?
Progressive anti-abortion uprising.
Yeah.
They had drums. They had wild signs that made no sense.
Oh, there was one guy that was like queer.
Gay. Or he was a queer Jewish.
Pro-palace. Oh, ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now and
anti-abortion.
Total life.
Pro-life.
Yeah. Pro-life. Yes.
And you're like,
yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Who
I was like, what is he doing? What's he doing? And he was loud. And if I would say anything, he was probably one of the most obnoxious antis there. I don't think he got the memo that this was the respectability rally.
Yeah.
And so he brought what we are normally used to, which is just a lot more flavor, but like bad flavor.
Yep. And then our rally was thrown by the ACLU and some other folks. Some providers spoke, advocates spoke. But we brought the fire.
Oh my God, our signs were so good. I just want to give a little background. So last time we were at the Supreme Court protesting, it was for the Dobbs oral argument. And Liz looked around and she was like, our signs are too small.
So, and I just want to say, when you see them outside of the clinics with the like abortion porn and you know, the fetuses, like they had banners that big all over the place.
All over the place.
And we had signs that were beautiful, but looked like a cool Instagram post.
Some of them were like,
that way, by the 2 feet. And so last year we showed up with just the SCOTUS heads and they made a splash. So then we were all talking and it's like, you know what? Let's make big giant signs so we can take up real estate with a small amount of people. And then also just have something that's catchy for the media. So we made magazine covers of the 6 creepiest justices. We'll put a photograph.
They're really good.
And then we had
abortion pill protocol banner. So there are 2 ways one can use abortion pills. And we basically had with mifepristone and without mifepristone options. And that was really, really great and beautiful.
Yeah, because then anybody who sees that, they can just say, oh, here's how you take mifepristone. So if you're ever to procure it somehow, you would know how to take it safely.
And because we had these cool banners, we got to partner with Aid Access. And listeners of the pod may remember that the doctor from Aid Access, Dr. Rebecca Gompertz, was on the pod just a few weeks ago. And she came all the way from Europe.
Yeah, the Nethers.
The Nethers.
She came from the Nether regions to defend our Nether regions.
To defend our access to abortion pills. And they brought these cute-ass robots.
Oh, this is so cool, y'all. So they had these robots that were being manned or personed by robotically.
Robotic lady.
Oh, remotely. From people that are in
states with shield laws. So states where people cannot be prosecuted for interacting with abortion pills. We have some of those states in this country. And so people who were from those states or who had privileges in those states were the ones managing the robot so they couldn't be prosecuted if someone decided to say, look at you from Texas, here with abortion pills.
Yeah. And so the robot was shooting out pills.
Yeah.
And you can see all this stuff on our social. It was really great. And then our guest for next week, who we'll plug again, but Elizabeth Booker, who has become a great friend of ours, showed up and showed out with the signs, chasing down antis, blocking their signs the best. That was really fun. And our team just really showed up and was really great and solid and energetic. And so it was really great to partner with Aid Access, to be in community. Mm-hmm. And it really felt like we were sort of dominating the conversation.
Which was great because when we were at Dobbs just 2 years ago, remember that was 2021, the end of 2021. When we were at Dobbs, it actually felt like we were overwhelmed. And Alyssa's going to speak more to this, but it really felt like we were on the losing side and we were. Yeah. We lost.
So Moji and I took off around 9:30, and that's when the swell of like the people had started to come slowly, but the busloads of people started coming in, and we really saw them moving in, and it felt really great. And so Alyssa and the AAF team stayed because also Molly Gaby, who if you watch our TikToks, you know how great Molly is. Molly dressed up like Comstock and was Comstocking.
Oh my God. Comstocking.
Comstocking.
All over the place.
The antis, everybody. Mark Lee Dixon, who we've talked about on the pod, who's that dude that like is trying to get make sanctuary cities a thing. All over the place. And he's saying that the Comstock Act should be revived. And Molly dressed up like Comstock. He was at SCOTUS. Molly saw him and she's like, you're my people. Blow. And then, of course, like everybody does, he like cowered away. He was like telling his people, hide your Comstock signs when you see that guy coming. It's like that guy.
Oh, you don't believe in your whole Comstock new grift? Oh, no, no, you don't. Okay.
Yeah. You got an old white haired lady and a woman dressed up like Comstock coming at you and you're running scared. Like it's like professional wrestlers or something. It was hilarious. And so we're going to be putting up a ton of footage with Comstock, and our Instagram's already loaded up with that. Okay, so Moji and I told you what we saw, but that's not enough because we had to leave to prep for the pod. But Alyssa was in there, out there, doing it, staying till the bitter end. And we have Alyssa still at the Supreme Court. Hey, Dukes.
Hey, Liz and Moji. How's it going inside where it's not thrilling and exciting and history? I mean, you know, we're in some kind of hotel conference room thing. So it probably sounds like shit. We don't know.
We have no idea.
We're just winging the whole day. So we kind of filled people in a little bit about being there at 5 a.m. and just a little bit about the vibes. But talk about as it came to sort of like critical mass and there was people everywhere. How did it feel like outnumbered wise? It was like, did we feel like we were of equal footing? Did it feel like 50-50? What was it?
There were maybe a quarter of the anti-abortion side compared to how many of us there were. I kept hearing this huge roar of noise and I was like, what is that? And I was like, oh, wait, that's us. I mean, pro-abortion folks showed up in force today and the vibes were positive, fun. Everybody was seeing old friends, getting really excited as we got news from inside the porch as it trickled about who was out here. As you can see, we're still dancing to Beyonce. So things are good.
I think one of the things that really struck me for a little bit of time we were out there is that our side, right, definitely have the music pumping. Like, I love that you're still jumping to Beyonce. When we went to hold our signs up at the anti-side when they were doing their rally, it was so dry.
Yeah, their side looked like a brewery conference. It was not as exciting as ours. They were having a lot more fun. We at AAF were out here with Anthony Comstock himself. It was absolutely hilarious because the anti didn't judge that he wasn't necessarily on their side. So we got a lot of fun interactions with them. Our signs looked incredible. We had these huge signs and we just absolutely drowned out the anti-abortion side.
You know, it felt like there's a lot at stake with this case. And so the feeling outside of the court is often the feeling that sort of is the larger feeling of what's going on in America, right? And it felt like there was a lot of good vibes going on from our side. And their side was, you know, it was a lot of men. There was a lot of men screaming. There was also a lot of what I noticed, and Dukes, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about this, co-opting our language and the way that they had their signs up that were sort of innocuous. You couldn't tell what side they're on as though they weren't proud of their beliefs. Did that continue?
100%. I think they had people out here in doctor's coats with signs that said women should have access to health care. But then they were out here defending from the Alliance Defending Freedom, who's in there trying to take away our access to the person, making it sense. But like I said, like based on vibes alone, the takeaway here is that the American people want to protect abortion access, and we're going to come out here and we're going to be as loud as people.
We were out here, Liz and I were out here during the arguments for the Dobbs, not the decision, but for the Dobbs oral arguments, similar to today, the oral arguments for the Mifepristone case. And it actually felt like we had not gotten the memo that our rights were on the line then. And there were some key things I think we brought to this that were different from before. Our signs were huge. Our signs were focused. And I feel like more people, more Americans were like, oh shit, we can't let Dobbs happen to us again right now. So, Alyssa, do you think that that also speaks to what you experienced when you stayed out there? As we were leaving, we saw more people busing in from other parts of the country. So, like, does that speak to what you see?
Yeah, 100%. It felt like as soon as there was the most people that we'd seen out here, another busload of people came out here, and they were all here to say, we want to keep our Mifepristone. Please let me have as many abortion pills as those little robots can shoot out. Which, let's shout out the robots, shall we? Aid Access is out here with these cute robots dispensing Mifepristone, and they were a delight. I didn't get to eat a Mifepristone. That would have been great.
So I want to know, we left too early. Did the shofars come out?
You know, shofar, I haven't seen any.
No, not shofar.
My God, you did not.
Okay. I've been hanging on to that one since last night.
You really did. So as people are packing up and leaving, and we're about to go talk to Dr. Goodwin, we all listen to the oral arguments. And I don't know, Alyssa, you've been out in these streets. I don't know if there's been conversations with folks that are on the street about what happened inside there, but we feel really good about Amy Coney Barrett, Gorsuch, even Clarence Thomas being like, nah, son.
I mean, that's how you know you have no standing whatsoever is when those three.
And so, Dukes, I know you have to go because, you know, it's loud and you're on the street. But what would you tell the folks that are listening about sort of the takeaway of the vibes? And as you leave today, should people walk away with hope?
Yeah, people should definitely walk away with hope. And if you have not come out here and shown with your body and your voice and your actions that you're here to support abortion access, you're not alone. There's hundreds of people out here, and we're all a community fighting to make sure that we have access, and we're strong, and we're having fun. And this is the way it should be.
Awesome. Yeah, Dukes, thank you so much for being our correspondent from SCOTUS. I wish I was out there getting the vibes with you, but it looks like it was a great time.
I can't wait to hear your conversation with Dr. Michelle Goodwin on what happened inside. I can't wait to get the deets from you.
Awesome. Well, have fun. I know you're taking Comstock out on a tour of DC. And we can't wait for that also. So thanks a bunch. Be well.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you later.
Well, let's get to the meat of the matter, because the case involving what is going to be the status of abortion pills in America is what everybody's been talking about. And when we knew we were coming down to the Supreme Court, there was only one person we wanted to talk to, and that person is Dr. Michelle Goodwin, law professor at Georgetown, one of the most thorough constitutional scholars around and one of the most incredible reproductive justice scholars out there in the streets. And of course, we always say it,
Our board member.
So here to help walk us through what we all just listened to and make sense of it all. And hopefully to give us some hope, because Moji and I are feeling a little hopeful. So we're going to ask Dr. Goodwin if we should. Without further ado, it's Michelle Goodwin. Dr. Goodwin, we are so excited to talk to you of all people after hearing these oral arguments. Moji and I listened with both of our ears, and we want to get your sort of overview take and then break some things down. But are we wrong to feel cautiously optimistic?
Cautiously optimistic.
No, not wrong to be cautiously optimistic, though one has to just put a disclaimer out there that in the Dobbs decision, it was a case brought by the state of Mississippi, which had a 15-week abortion ban. That ban had been stayed. There was an injunction imposed by Judge Carlton Reeves in one of the best district court opinions that I've ever read. And the Supreme Court very well could have just deferred to the 15-week abortion ban that Mississippi had originally legislated. And instead, what the court did was to overturn Roe and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. So that's the nightmare situation. But I think your intuitions are absolutely right. This court today showed that it was skeptical, a bit cynical about the claims that were being brought by the plaintiffs in this case. And so coming out of this, given Justice Gorsuch, given the liberal justices, given even Amy Coney Barrett, one could be cautiously optimistic.
Well, let's talk a little bit about sort of what they laid out in this case, right? It seemed like they were trying to prove that they somehow were going to suffer harm in this futuristic, hypothetical way.
I think the word they used was probabilistic. I was like, oh, I've never used that word before. That's a fun word.
Yeah. So that was one. And then Amy Coney Barrett wasn't buying it. Clarence Thomas wasn't buying it. Gorsuch wasn't buying it. And of course, all the liberals weren't buying it. You know, talk a little bit about standing and what standing actually means, yeah. And that you can't have all these hypotheticals and act like someday somehow you could be aggrieved in some hypothetical way.
That's right. So there's a reason why there is standing. So those who listen today and those will be reading the papers about this heard a lot about Article 3 standing. That is, what are the constitutional requirements in order to bring a challenge? What that requires is that you have to have, euphemistically stated, some skin in the game. This means that you have to be affected by the legislation, the regulation, what's at stake in the litigation itself. You can't be a bystander simply peering through your social media, peering through the glass, or otherwise in order to bring a claim. There are reasons for this. You don't want courts to be overtaxed and overwhelmed by people who just on a theory, just on a hunch, challenge cases. And so in this case, you have a group of individuals who had to claim that somehow they were personally affected and aggrieved by mifepristone being in the marketplace. It's worth noting that they specifically sought out a particular judge that they thought that they would be given some deference in front of. That's Judge Matthew Kaczmarek. He's new to the bench. He was a Trump nominee who got confirmed. It's worth just noting that during the confirmation process, even though he's been an outspoken anti-abortion activist and lawyer, during the confirmation hearings, he wanted to quiet that down. So much so that he had his name removed from a law review article that was about to be published that further supported anti-abortion sentiments. These particular litigants brought their case before him. He is the only district court judge that sits in Amarillo, Texas, which is where they brought this. And what they wanted to do was to remove mifepristone from the marketplace entirely. Their claim was that, two claims first, and then what gives them standing. The claim was that this was a rush to market by the FDA, and that secondly, mifepristone is unsafe, causes harm to people who use it for the termination of a pregnancy. They claimed that they had skin in the game, that they were affected by this, that they were affected in the past and the present, could be in the future, by claiming that, one, they were all doctors who would be sought after to help people who've had an abortion and are aggrieved or injured. It's worth noting that amongst those who were framed as doctors, this included a dentist and who has a master's degree in theology, not individuals that people would probably seek out if they were having trouble with a pregnancy. What we heard in oral arguments is that of those seven, there were only two that could come close, and still they were very, very far, miles, universes apart, from actually being able to state a real claim of being affected. In fact, what the justices pointed out over and over again is that none could show that somehow they had been a party to an abortion where they were forced to perform an abortion, where they were coerced to perform an elective abortion against their interest. If I could just take a moment with this, just as we think about standing and whether this group was qualified to be able to show before the court that they had skin in the game, that they were affected by this, that there was some causal relationship between the law and how they were harmed. It's worth noting just how far Judge Kaczmarek went in this case. The FDA approved mifepristone in 2000. Here we are in 2024. The statute of limitation ran in 6 years. So Judge Kaczmarek, by not only conceding that somehow there was standing in this case, that somehow a dentist and a theologian might be prepared abortion, also looked past the standard, which is that statutes of limitations matter. One of the things that you learn when you're in law school is that there is the, should be, the arc towards justice and people being able to get relief when they have been harmed. But at the same time, courts are very wary of individuals bringing claims that just don't hold up, which would overburden courts, tax resources, etc. And this is why standing matters, right? And this is also why statutes of limitations matter. The idea is that if you've been aggrieved or harmed, you shouldn't have to bring that case tomorrow or by next week, but that there are going to be limits on the number of years that you would have in order to bring that claim. So Judge Kaczmarek went very far in this case by overlooking standing standards, by overlooking statute of limitations. And then one other matter that came up, which Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson really hit home with, and that is the matter about the credibility of the claims themselves, right? And the credibility of judges being the ones to take up these matters. Question being, should there be deference to the Food and Drug Administration and the rigorous process that they undergo in the approval of drugs that come into the marketplace? And with concession that there may be times that drugs come into the marketplace that are unsafe, but there is a process of a review that the Food and Drug Administration goes through. Is it then, or should it be left to the Food and Drug Administration or taken up by judges? And this is where Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's intervention really scored a home run in many ways. And that is to say, she pointed out or left open so that the federal government could point out that the scientific evidence relied upon by those who brought forth this claim to remove mifepristone from the market, They relied on studies that have been retracted, that have been discredited. They relied on, and Judge Kaczmarek relied on then, what were anonymous blog posting. And so you hold up literally years worth of investigation, studies, reports done by the FDA, as well as the company that has manufactured mifepristone. You look at all of that evidence, and the thumb on the scale by Kaczmarek was for studies that have been discredited and as well anonymous blog posts. And so she raised this important question about who should be in the business of handling these matters, judges, or leave it to the Food and Drug Administration, as the Supreme Court has historically done for almost a century.
I really am glad that you brought up, when talking about standing, also relief, because I think when listening to the oral arguments, the tide turned to me when I think it was Gorsuch and Justice Jackson who brought up, what's the relief for these seven people who brought the case forth? And do we all have to live under whatever world they want to live in? I think that Gorsuch particularly said, like, don't we have a remedy for this? Like, why do we have to have a whole legislative assembly of the FDA rules when we could just address the complaint and that relief? When you call to standing, there has to be some relief, and the relief should be comparable to whatever the crime is or whatever the injustice is.
And that the relief already exists in the name of the federal conscience clause, right? And so I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that, because that was hammered home constantly. And for some reason, all of the justices seem to profoundly understand how the conscience clause works, which I felt really, I think that's what gave me the most calm. But Aaron Hawley just kept pushing back on the fact that it was, they were unable to use the conscience clause.
It wasn't enough.
In their hypothetical cases.
Right.
Right. So what conscience clauses provide for is that individuals who object on religious grounds to engaging in a particular conduct can be exempt from that. You might think about, for example, someone who is opposed to military service because it might involve killing someone else if called upon to do that in a time of war, might have a conscious objection, let's say. Conscious objections exist in medicine too, where individuals who, for religious reasons, would be opposed to engaging in a particular medical procedure, including, for example, abortion or dispensing contraception. Those exemptions already exist. They already exist in federal law. They already exist within the broader nomenclature of American society. And this was hammered over and over again by the justices. For the seven individuals who were involved in this case, who perceived themselves as being aggrieved in the future or harmed in the future, or what they're arguing is that they've been harmed in the present by the very idea that they might have to help an individual who's in distress, who's in a distress because of an abortion, a miscarriage, etc. They seem to conflate, right? So let me just take one moment for that. Their argument is that they would be opposed for religious reasons and other reasons perhaps to engage in elective abortions, and that individuals who've taken mifepristone, which they argue is very unsafe, even though empirical evidence show that it's safer than even taking Tylenol, but I digress. But their argument is that it's incredibly unsafe, and being so unsafe and the volume of people who use mifepristone to terminate pregnancies, that it's possible that these individuals will end up in the ER, and that ending up in the ER, they will be in the kind of medical distress that will call upon these individuals, including a theologian and a dentist, to come to their aid, help to further evacuate the uterus. Now, it was interesting here, and Amy Coney Barrett asked questions, Justice Amy Coney Barrett asked questions about, well, is this also the case involving when there is a deceased fetus and deceased fetal tissue? But that all aside, their argument is that they're going to be put in that position. Now, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson pushed back and said, well, show me in the record where they've actually had to do that. Show me in the record where the seven have had to do that, or even drill down to the two that, you know, were continually brought up. Show in the record where they have testified, right? Not just in theory, but where they have actually had to testify that they have been put in the position where they have to do that. And that's where the record was incredibly weak for these people. Also, aside from all of this, and this was something that Justice Sotomayor spoke to, Justice Kagan spoke to, et cetera, which is that with religious objections, with these objection clauses, the way in which they work is not something that's just spur of the moment. It's not that someone just suddenly has a religious objection, or perhaps they come to that, but usually those are matters that they register with the pharmacy. Pharmacists can have religious objections, conscientious objections, but usually they register these things such that their employers know about it, such that at the hospital is already on notice that these are ER doctors or doctors who are not ER doctors, but could be called to the ER, but they know already, don't call these people when these particular conditions emerge, because they have a religious objection that is recognized in law. The plaintiffs in this case wanted to push past that, and they said that that was not enough. The only way in which their 7 litigants could be satisfied is if mifepristone is off of the market for all other doctors and for all patients who would like to use it.
And Dr. Brown-Jackson really hammered that point home to say, it seems that your point is because you have a conscientious objection that nobody should have access to this. And for me, Dr. Goodwin, one of the things that was boiled down, and I think it was Justice Roberts, so correct me if I'm wrong on this, when Justice Roberts said, it seems like this should just be a small case of like 7 people who were looking for some relief.
I think it was Gorsuch to that.
Yeah. And you're trying to turn it, and it's turning into this major impact. And I the way that I interpreted it was, what's wrong with you? In a weird way.
And that makes a lot of sense, especially given that remedies already exist. And right. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson kept, you know, was insistent about, well, here are remedies that already exist for you. Isn't this something that is outsized that you're asking for? You're asking for something that is not proportionate to the injury that you claim. And then it was Justice Gorsuch who then chimed in and said, well, let me reframe so that you could understand what my colleague, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, is actually saying here, that you want something that is really outsized for your level of individuals affected. Now, let's take one pause on this, right? And one pause would be the following. If there's even one person in this country who is subjected to a system of slavery, it's something we should all be concerned about and that the court would intervene on. No slavery for anybody in this country. I raise that only because there may be some instances where there is one party who has been affected and there is some rulemaking with regard to how this could apply to the entire country, what could be implicated by this. Where that does not stand in this case at all is that here you have individuals who already have a relief that is available to them, conscious clauses. But there's also something that was not addressed in the oral arguments today. We touched on just slightly, but not as substantially as perhaps there should be in the oral arguments or should be in the future. That is the role and responsibility of doctors themselves. At the backdrop of this, their claim is that there are women who are suffering, who come into ERs after using mifepristone. What was teased out and made clear is that there may be people who do go to the hospital who may use the ER after it is that they've used this regimen in order to terminate a pregnancy. But that does not mean that they're in a medical crisis. A lot of people will go to an ER when they have a cold, when they have a flu. That is not to make little of colds and flu, but for a lot of Americans, they use the ER as a place of medicine. The real question is, as in this case, since the claim was that these are drugs that are unsafe, unhealthy, and that people are harmed and experience significant injury, the question is, does that happen in the hospital? I mean, is that true that because of mifepristone, that is taking place in the ER? Their lawyers couldn't respond effectively to that because it is not. So while it may be true that people may be going to the hospital, it is not true that they are in the medical crisis that was being claimed by the individuals in this case. And so then you have really these seven people who are trying then to do a workaround, right? Using the systems of law, and they already got their way up to the Supreme Court, right, which I think says a lot in and of itself. These seven people could use, or some would argue, abuse the systems of law and their lawyers too, to bring a case that would go all the way to the Supreme Court. They should have been dismissed from the start at the district court level.
I'm really glad you also touched on the fact that how did this happen? Because also when listening to this, like you listen to the attorney for the government, for the FDA, you listen to the attorney for the drug manufacturer, and they had well-reasoned arguments. And then it seemed like the attorney for the plaintiffs just had three talking points. And even when the justices would reframe their questions and ask her to simplify or like really tease out where she was going, she kept repeating the same three things, which is the emergency room numbers possibly going up, the injury of conscience that the people may ever have. And I believe there was one other thing she kept saying.
Well, the injury of having to bring the lawsuits as though they were forced, right.
Well, there's that
to bring the lawsuits. It's like, well,
but I actually want to get to like, how can you get this far to the Supreme Court and have three steps to your argument that would affect millions of people in this country?
Well, if your three arguments were ones that were substantive before law, I think that the problem was the weakness of the arguments, the kind of cynicism embedded in the argument, the greed and exploitation and coercion embedded in the arguments, the kinds of way in which the anti-abortion movement has been able to strategically utilize its political relationship such that it could then bring a case that would get this far. I mean, if we take a step back, what we saw today is part of the legacy of the former president, Donald Trump, where when he was campaigning for president leading up to the 2016 election, he spoke about how he supported punishing women who would want to terminate pregnancies, how he was going to be the president that would undo Roe v. Wade, how when he was president, he made sure that he would deliver on that, and that since he has been president, he has been very public about strategizing in terms of who he put on court to deliver outcomes such as this. In reality, one could argue that the judges and justices who came through that process should try to disavow themselves as being connected to that blatantly political process that begs for federal judges to relieve themselves of their duties of professional responsibility, their duties of objectiveness and taking the cases based on precedent, et cetera, in terms of their deliberation. They should want to distance themselves from the former president and what appears to be purely partisan kind of politicking making its way into the judiciary. Sure, that happens within the context of the legislature, but what the former president did was to tell the country and to tell the world that now he has fastened that to the American judiciary. So I say that as a start to then the question about these rather reductive and vacuous arguments that we heard today coming from the litigants in this case. I think the reason why, as you say, the same arguments were repeated over and over again, there were two reasons. One, it was very clear that both conservative and liberal justices were not buying it at all. And that two is just the fact that there wasn't much else to stand on. How do you fill up the time in oral arguments if you have nothing else? And you have nothing else because this is a case where your litigant should never have been able to pursue this case because they didn't have standing. And secondly, because the statute of limitations should have told where this case shouldn't have made it as far as it did. And three, we must never lose sight of the fact that on the other side of their argument, if their arguments are to be taken seriously, what they're basically saying is that people who've sworn a Hippocratic oath to take care of people who are committed, should be committed to principles of bioethics, would leave people to suffer and potentially die because of their objection to helping people who want and need to terminate a pregnancy.
What about those whose moral and ethical and fundamental makeup is to make sure that they intervene in all causes and would never deny someone an abortion because as a physician,
that is something that they would do. What about their conscience? Right. Like that is never, it doesn't even enter into it.
Right.
I think that that was part of what Justices Kagan and Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson kept coming back to. Why give you this kind of relief that would then pose as a barrier to other physicians, to patients who need this kind of healthcare? And I think that one could tease out a little bit with Justice Amy Coney Barrett too. I thought when I was listening to her questioning during the oral arguments that somehow she was paying attention. Who knows if I'm right on this? I could be very wrong. But I couldn't help but think that she was perhaps paying attention to the tragedies unfolding across the United States where people need to manage miscarriages because they could die, they will die, and because deaths have taken place. In those instances, well, you can't ask the theologian to come in and intervene.
Or the dentist.
Seriously, for the people who are obstetricians and gynecologists as part of this group, the two, in an instance where someone is dying and but for this medical intervention, would you deny them medical relief? Now, she didn't ask a question such as that, but she did at least try to push then Holly to respond to the following, which is that it's not clear that the people who appear in emergency rooms in need of uterine evacuation or abortion have gotten there because of mifepristone. It could be, and this was not something really followed up on, but I think part of her point was that, look, the United States has the highest rate of maternal mortality amongst all peer nations. It ranks around 55th in the world. It has the highest rate of maternal morbidity of any peer country, ranking again incredibly high in the entire world. To the extent that there are people who are appearing in emergency rooms in crisis and needing reproductive health care, as we know from the Kate Cox case, you know, as we know from other cases across the country, it's not from mifepristone, right?
Right.
This may very well be just because naturally, right, in about 20%, somewhere up to 30% potentially, miscarriages and stillbirths occur.
It was interesting, Dr. Goodwin, because when Erin Holly was pushed on her two, you know, clients that she swore were the poster children for standing, and she said one of them had to engage in some pregnancy termination in some way 12 times over the course of her career. You know, Moji and I looked it up, and that person's been a doctor for 15 years. And then Erin Holly said, we also have our own evidence that that doctor said that they had an increase in having to treat people. So we were like, well, did it go from 8 to 12? You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't very great, you know? So she was almost caught up in her own rhetoric. And we have to wrap up. But the one thing I did want to ask you is, Erin Holly's insistence on talking about emergency rooms over and over again, and the framing always was, doctors don't have time, doctors don't have time. We, Moji and I were wondering, is this a setup? For those who are listening, next month, we are going to be hearing the emergency room case on whether or not the federal law that says if you take Medicaid funding and you are a hospital, you have to intervene to stabilize a patient, and that can go against state law, right? So Idaho's bringing this case, and it makes me wonder if Erin Holly somehow knew in her britches that this case was not going to go well for her, but that EMTALA might be the case that they're looking at. Do you think that they're going to try to hang their hat on this emergency room case?
So even the justices were bringing up other cases from this term. So that may very well be a teeing up. And in fact, that was raised in some way, like this question about, well, what about EMTALA? Does EMTALA trump a religious objection clauses or conscience clauses, and EMTALA does not? So even in the case of a medical emergency where someone needs to be stabilized, which the Emergency Medical and Treatment and Labor Act provides for, it would not force a doctor who has a conscience clause objection to perform that emergency care, but instead would be someone else who is at that hospital that would provide care. But clearly, this was a teeing up. The reality is that for a number of years, those who have been part of a hard religious right have been trying and spending resources in figuring out the various kinds of ways to dismantle abortion rights and reproductive freedoms more broadly, you know, every little bit by bit. So whichever argument might work today or work in front of a court or the Supreme Court are the arguments that are being vetted and put out. And I think that today we saw a bit of a prelude to what's to come next.
Dr. Goodwin, thank you for laying it out so much for us. You're always just the best at helping folks understand things that can be really complicated and really scary. So thank you so much for giving us hope.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Moji, it is so fun to sort of be back in the game and live and out in these like Washington, D.C. streets when there's a SCOTUS case, because Dobbs was so depressing. This one felt like hope, and it was just exciting. I felt like great. I felt like the DC volunteers, we got a bunch of new ones.
Such great volunteers.
And the team was super excellent. And, you know, I feel like it's one of the things we do best is taking to the streets and making some noise. And whenever you read any article about what happened and you see those magazines, just know it's your friends. It's AAF.
Yes.
That's right. So that's it. That's the show.
It was such a good show. Oh my God, I really enjoyed this. You know, every time we get to talk to Dr. Goodwin, it just feels like a treat.
It does feel like a treat. And I feel like today's the day more than ever as we sit here and watch all the ways that they are trying to steal, destroy, and disrupt access to abortion. There's always the reminder that if you're like, I don't know what to do, where do I go? I don't know if there's abortion near me. Here's the deal. You go to aafront.org. You can find funding for your care. You can find resources on accessing your care with our cute little Charlie chatbot that's in the bottom right of the screen. You'll find our cute little Charlie chatbot who will walk anyone anywhere in the whole country through their options and resources of where they can access abortion.
Yes. Thank you again, Dr. Goodwin, for lending your expertise. Thank you to Alyssa for calling in with the rally update. And thank you to all of the incredible DC volunteers who showed up, showed out, and held the banners high.
And thank you to our AAF team who organized a great rally. Shout out especially to the program's department of Kristen and Sherelle and Emily, who really just like got it going. So thanks so much, everybody. Did you like the episode? Did we make you a little smarter? Did we make you laugh? Well, if we did, show us some love by liking, subscribing, and giving us a 5-star rating. Plus, stay connected with us on social media at Abortion Front across all platforms, because you don't want to just sit on the sidelines. You want to join us and get in the action. And you want to get in the action like right now, right this second, like it has to do with Miffy, like all the things that can happen, go to the website, aafront.org, and sign our petition and ask the FDA to use their power to protect Miffy Pristone.
And then when you're done with that and you're looking for more opportunities to do some abortion activism, well, we've got a 5-part activist training series, Operation Save Abortion, at operationsaveabortion.com, and visit our super cool activist calendar, which is full of local and national actions and education opportunities. On Thursday, April 4th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, AAF is excited to be partnering with the Reproductive Justice Collective at Columbia University for an Expose Fake Clinics College Action Hour. It's virtual and open to all, and this action will focus on basic fake clinic education and how college students can take action. Link is in our activist calendar.
And as always, we have the dopest guests. And next week, look out with Asha Diet, director and producer of the documentary Someone You Know. It's a short film on late term abortion. Asha is fantastic, and I am so excited. And the aforementioned comedian, social scientist, political content creator, Elizabeth Booker, aka Booker Squared on Insta and TikTok, who held it down.
Held it down.
Today.
Are you feeling generous? Join our Patreon. You'll support great content and get cool FBK merch and experiences. All pledges support this pod and all of our activism at Abortion Access Front. Pledge at patreon.com/feministbuzzkills. FBK is edited by Remy de Tournay and is produced by Abortion Access Front.
And one more time for the people in the back. Thank God for Michelle Goodwin, because wow, sometimes I just can't even understand this shit. And like, it was so funny because I was like, we have to ask her about Article 3. And then we didn't have to ask her about Article 3 because she just like about laid out Article 3 being like, these two need to know about Article 3. So if you needed to know about Article 3, let's just lift one. Let's just hoist one up in the air for Michelle Goodwin. That's our show. We're not even showing our whole ass because our whole asses are all over the internet with our signs.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody. Like and share it.
Feminist Buzzkills, the podcast from Abortion Access Front. New episodes drop Friday. When BS is poppin', we pop off. And if you want to support our podcast and all the work of Abortion Access Front, like, subscribe, and join our Patreon at patreon.com/feministbuzzkills.